Getting paper on his player, haters old news, money on the other line. So ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another edition of I'm Not Gonna Hold You, the offseason, man. My offseason interview series, man. We've got another special guest here today, man. We've got sports author, executive producer of HBO show Winning Time, Jeff Perlman. Thank you for joining me today, man. How's it going?
I did you wrong. We were supposed to do this interview several hours ago. I apologize. It's my bad. Because I just want to say, as a journalist, I hate when people blow me off or forget interviews. So it pisses me off. So you have every right to be mad at me, and you've been very great. I apologize.
It's all good, man. Thank you. Thank you for coming on, man. First of all, I just want to say I'm a big fan of the show Winning Time. That's something I've been watching weekly. I did not miss an episode when it was airing. Originally, you know, it stems from your book called Showtime: Magic, Kareem, Riley, and the Los Angeles Lakers Dynasty of the 1980s. Basically, man, how did, you know, this whole thing start, you know, from the book that came out 8 years ago to being what the show is today? How did everything come about?
Well, you know, like, I wrote the book and I just thought of it as a book. Like, it's not like when you write, I don't think most authors think like, man, I hope one day this becomes an HBO show. Like, that would be
right.
Preposterous, you know, like, well, that's not going to happen. But shortly after the book came out, I was a screenwriter, aspiring screenwriter named Jim Hatch, reached out to me and just loved the book and said he really wanted to make in something. He had this vision and he came to my house. I lived in New York at the time. He came to my house and he had all these dreams about this could be great and it could be a series and blah, blah, blah. And I didn't believe any of it. Like, I just didn't believe any of it. I mean, it sounded good, but it didn't sound realistic. But I gave him the rights to the book. So basically, I signed a contract where he had the rights to negotiate it and try to find a deal. And through the years, he'd update me. But it was, I never took it seriously.
Right.
And then a bunch of years ago, he said, Adam McKay wants to meet with us. And I didn't know who Adam McKay was. I had no idea. So I Google Adam McKay and I see he's done a ton of movies and a ton of shows. And he's an alum of SNL and a bunch of different places. And I go to his house with this guy, Jim Hecht, and he's very, you know, oh, I love the book and it's so great. And this could really be something. And at the end of it, I think, well, this is all BS. This is never going to happen.
Right.
And then, like, not that long ago, someone forwarded me like a press release and it was like new HBO series based on Showtime book to star. I don't know who it was, Adrian Brody or Sally Field or someone. I was like, whoa, what? And then there would be another one, HBO series to star this guy and this woman. And after a while, I was like, wow, this is actually happening. And it started filming in 2019, right before the pandemic. I had to take time off during the pandemic. And it's almost like one day you blink and here's a show based on your book. And you're, right. I don't know how it happened. Yeah.
So with that whole process, I know I've read a couple articles on like how everything went down. Like, how hands-on were you as far as like, you know, the casting, what stories are we going to use? Were you that hands-on with it?
Oh, minimal. First of all, I shouldn't have been. Like, I wrote the book, right? And that means I handed this source material and they buy the rights to it. But I'm not a filmmaker, you know, like I'm not a filmmaker. So what I did is I read all the scripts, which is cool. I gave my opinions on the scripts, which is cool. My wife and I both had cameos and my kids all had appearances in the first episode as extras, not cameos, extras. That was cool. They asked my opinion about a lot of stuff along the way. Is this realistic? Could this happen? How was this? But it's not, again, like, I think most writers, when this happens to them, either the production company basically says, please stay away from this, or they have minimal involvement. And these guys were so gracious and they kept me involved the whole time. But I do not, I didn't write a word of the script. I kind of proofread it over, but you know, my involvement really was advising, I guess, more than anything.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So like with the, I know since the show has come out, like, and I really feel like really towards like the last couple of episodes, we started to see like former players and that like speak out about, well, this didn't go that way or that didn't go there. Has there been anybody who specifically reached out to you, or what do you feel about like the backlash from the players who say that this isn't how it went down?
So I haven't had anyone reach out to me specifically, player wise. I always say I totally get it. Like, the thing is, so I never had anyone complain about the book. Like, okay. I never had Magic or Kareem or West or any of those guys complain about the book. Never. Not one person said, you got this wrong, the book isn't right. The thing about a TV show like this is it's not a documentary.
Right.
It's not a documentary. It's not. It's entertainment. So, you know, I've used this line before and I really mean it. Like, from name your favorite sports movie that's based on a real event. It could be We Are Marshall. It can be Friday Night Lights. It could be, you know, any of those. Rudy, whatever. They all take like flourishes. They all make exaggerations. They all go into character development that wasn't a part of the source material. It's just what it is, you know? So I get Jerry West saying, wait, that wasn't. And I get Paul Westhead saying, wait, that wasn't, or Magic or Cream. Like, I get it. But that this is not a documentary. It's not. It's based on true events. But there are flourishes and exaggerations and scenes that didn't happen exactly like they have it. It's just part of the, I kind of had to accept that, you know, like I just kind of had to accept that. Yeah.
Okay. And so, like, with one thing I like the most about this show to me as watching, I'm a big, not just basketball, sports, like, historian guy, everything. Like, when I was born, it was like, I was born like maybe a couple months after the Lakers won back to back in 88. So, like, this is all, like, of course, like, before my time, but I've gone back and I've, you know, read these stories and know things about that. And I feel like the casting was like A1. Like, I've never seen a show where it was like, it was this spot on with all the guys. For you, now, of course, you said they advised you and things like that. Like, how, what did you like the most about, like, seeing the book being depicted on air? Like, was any parts of it that you like, okay, this is, looks even a little better than what I thought it would look?
Oh yeah. I thought the casting was brilliant. Just brilliant. And what I'll tell you what I love the most is, all right, like Quincy Isaiah, who's playing Magic, Solomon Hughes playing Kareem, Delonte D'Souza, Michael Cooper, Aaron Austin is Mark Landsberger, you know, on and on and on, right? Like, it's all these newbies who are young to the business, right? And like I was saying to Quincy, I was like, early on, I was like, you're a guy who's playing like Division III college football, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago, and you're starring, not just in, you are starring in an HBO series with John C. Reilly and Adrian Brody and Sally Field. That is bonkers. Like, that is absolutely bonkers. That's insane. And I freaking love that. I love that he had, like, these guys, their IMDb pages were zero. Like, they were zero. They didn't have any credits. Maybe they acted in college, or maybe they did a local commercial, but they did nothing. And, like, Delonte D'Souza, who plays Michael Cooper, who's just awesome. Like, he was flipping houses. He was in Maryland flipping houses. He'd been a youth actor. He'd acted in college in Maryland. And he saw this casting call for this show. He didn't know who Michael Cooper was. He wasn't very good at basketball, Delonte. And he kind of auditioned over Zoom. It was during the pandemic. And, like, the next thing you know, he's moving to Hollywood and he's in this HBO show. I love that stuff. Like, I love that stuff. You know, it exemplifies the Hollywood dream that the show kind of shows with Magic coming to LA and playing for the Lakers. So yeah, all the big name actors, it's cool, it's sweet, but seeing Quincy Isaiah and seeing Delonte and seeing Solomon, those guys like come of age, I freaking love it.
Yeah, I that was one thing I love too. Like, he was just like perfect for Magic for me. And even like this morning, I was watching, like, it was like a round table and it was him with like established actors like Michael Keaton, Samuel Jackson. I was like, that's got to be huge for him. Like you just said, his IMDb page was nothing. So now you're sitting here with, you know, Michael Keaton, the guy who was first Batman, you know, like that type of stuff had to be huge for him. So I said,
wait, I want to say one thing. I just want to say, like, not for nothing, and I really mean this. So we had most of the cast over for one of the episodes. We did a viewing party at my house.
Okay.
We had, you know, a lot, probably 50 people over here. It is such, I swear to God, I wouldn't say this if we weren't sure. I wouldn't make it up. Like, such a nice group of people and such a decent group of people. And, like, it has felt from the beginning like a collective experience. Like, all these people are going through this together. And it's like, it's almost like going to summer camp where you feel like you're experiencing this thing, this little magic in a bottle that's happening. And they're just awesome. I mean, they're just so freaking nice and grateful and happy and appreciative of this opportunity. The number of times someone in the show has said to me, man, this is all because of you, because you wrote the book. And I'm like, well, that's ridiculous. Like, I just wrote the book. This is not because of me. This is because of a lot of amazing things happening. But they're just, it's really like, during a really crappy run in America, Trump, COVID, you know, everything shut down. It's been a beacon of light for me and my family. Like, it truly has. So it's been awesome.
Yeah, and I even say, like, as a fan watching, it's just I like shows where it's like, you know, I feel like during the well, I won't say during because we're still in the pandemic, but like during quarantine, like it's like I would be binge watching a lot of shows, and I always feel like the binge model is cool, but at the same time, when you're done, you're like, all right, what I gotta watch now? So Wintertime has been something that's been dope to like watch weekly, like what's gonna be the new thing, and you know, since I know the story so well, it's been cool to see. On you know on video and things. So you know, my favorite character has to be Norm Nixon. I gotta give a shout out to
Devon. Yeah,
he plays his pops like to perfection. That he was great on that to me.
So great. And he oozes like he's a really nice guy. And in the show, he just oozes this sort of late 70s, early 80s kind of confident, like sexy vibe, kind of like I'm the man and I know it sort of thing. Little known fact, maybe you look this up. There's Devon Nixon. He played Whitney Houston's son in The Bodyguard.
Yeah, I found that on a Rich Eisen interview. He said that. I was like, well, I gotta go back and watch that again.
Yeah.
That's cool. It's like the whole little cast. I just feel like it just hit it to perfection. Now it got picked up for season two. Yep. Now I don't know. You said, of course, they come to you in an advisory role, but like. Do you know, like, or will have any idea of, like, is this going to be something where you're going to do the full Dynasty thing? Or is it going to be, because I know, like, the first shot of the first episode had Magic in the hospital. So I don't know if you guys had an idea it was going to come full circle or something like that.
I mean, I hope so. I guess in a lot of ways what happens is what you need for a show to do is continue to be successful, right? So season two is a continuation of sort of, I mean, the book goes from 79 to 91.
Okay.
And they optioned, I wrote a follow-up book called Three Ring Circus, which chronicles the Shaq Kobe years. And HBO optioned that book, meaning they have the rights to it. So let's just say everything in America went well and life was just perfect. This series goes for whatever, five or six seasons. And then they transition into the Shaq Kobe years. Now, a lot of things would have to go right.
Yeah.
But that'd be pretty amazing.
That would be something that was actually what I was going to ask you next about the Three Ring Circus, because that's the Lake era I grew up on. Like outside of Michael Jordan, obviously I'm from Chicago, but like outside of Michael Jordan, Kobe's my favorite player. So I remember that three-peat era vividly. So that would be something cool to see. And I know a lot of people would like to see that. Now, I want to take it back a little bit now. You have a lot of books on sports. Where did your love for sports come? Like, what made you want to start writing about these things? Because you got a lot from all three of the major sports.
Well, it's funny. I grew up in a small town, Mayopac, New York. My parents weren't into sports at all. My grandparents weren't into sports at all. My older brother was not into sports at all. I don't know why I felt. I think what it was for me, I don't know if you ever went through this. Like, when I was a kid, there was something about, like, the colors. There's something about, like, the bright uniforms and the cool names. Like, I grew up in this little tiny white bread conservative town in New York, right? It was almost all white. We were one of probably 10 Jewish families in the town, like not very multicultural at all. And I remember, like, I used to love, like, this is going to sound really dumb, but I used to love, like, the African-American ball players with, like, awesome afros, cool lamp top sideburns, and, like, lots of chains. And I love, like, the Dominican players like Rafael Santana, Julio Cruz, and, like, cool names from different places. And I love, like, the cool uniforms, like the Astros. Houston Astros used to have, like,
yeah, the old school Astros, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Or, like, you turn on an NBA game and you'd see, like, Sidney Moncrief. And you just be like, that is the coolest freaking name ever. Yeah. George finger roll for the Spurs. And, like, it all felt really explosive to me. You know, like, it all felt really freaking explosive to me and, like, dynamic. And, you know, small town, not much going on. That was kind of like it for me. And I used to run down. So I would go to the local library. I'm sorry, my dog's being a pain, but I would go down to the local library and I would take out sports books. And I would always, anyone's autobiography, any sports book I could find, I would take out. And it got to the point where the librarian would call me up at home and be like, hey, Jeff, we just got the new whatever, Billy Martin book or the next new Bo Jackson book. If you come down now, we'll hold it for you. And I would run the mile to the library, pick up the book, run home. And also my parents were too, we didn't get Sports Illustrated because SI was kind of expensive. But at the library, they'd get it every week. So I'd run down to the library, read Sports Illustrated cover to cover. And just like everything about that scene and sports and the colors and the dynamics and the names and the diversity, it just did it for me. And here I
am. So- I definitely had like a kind of a thing with that. Like with me, it's like my parents weren't big sports fans, but I remember like the first thing I remember watching from sports was the 1996 finals, and I remember watching my mom. I had to be like 8 years old at the time, and I was asking why Michael Jordan was crying when he won, and I found out it was Father's Day after his father just passed. Oh, yeah. Like after I started watching Mike, it just like opened my eyes to everything else. And from like all these books that you have, which one would you say was like the most fun or the best experience you had putting together, whether it's been the research, the people you were talking to and things like that?
Well, I did a book. Actually, you know, I have a book coming out. It's my 10th book. It's coming out in October. And I'm not just saying this because it's coming out. It's about Bo Jackson. And you know Bo Jackson?
Yeah, of course I know Bo.
Yeah. I'm just checking. You never know.
Yeah, yeah. Former White Sox, Auburn, whole thing.
Very nice. Former White Sox. Yeah, of course. You said you were a White Sox fan, so I should know. Yeah. And the thing I love about sport, like the books I write, I mean, I've written some books that don't go along with this, but most of them do. Like I'm big into nostalgia, right? Like I would say like food, music, sports are the three things that put you in the place where you can feel like you felt then. You know, like you said, right. 1996, you're a little kid. Why is Michael Jordan crying? If you watch a replay of that for a second, you can feel how you felt when you were
100%.
It's kind of like you smell some food that smells like your grandma's boiled carrots. And for a second, it puts you back in that place. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yep. It's just something about when you hear a song, you hear an old Hall & Oates song, you're like, oh, I remember being in the car.
Yeah. And the same thing is like when I was watching The Last Dance and they had the episode and when they were doing it, I was like, man, this takes me back to how I became a sports fan. I remember this moment like it was yesterday. So I definitely understand what you're talking about.
And that stuff is magical, man. Cause that stuff is, I'm telling you, my whole career isn't based on sports. It's based on nostalgia. It's about the two books. I've written 10 books. The two books I have not enjoyed, really not enjoyed. I wrote a book about Barry Bonds. I wrote a book about Roger Clemens. They're both baseball players I covered when I was at Sports Illustrated. They were contemporary of mine, a little older, but not by that much. And like, it didn't do it for me. But writing about like Bo Jackson, I'm a kid again. I'm watching Bo Jackson make his debut for the Kansas City Royals. And I'm so excited to see Bo Jackson playing the major leagues. What's he going to do? What's it going to be like? And it puts you in that place, you know, and it puts you in that feeling. So like, I love doing the Bo book. I wrote a book about an old football league called the USFL. It's a league that Donald Trump ruined.
Yeah.
And, but for me, it took me back to being 11 years old and this league coming along and Herschel Walker and Jim Kelly and Steve Young and Reggie White. And just like, I just love feeling nostalgic. So Winning Time to me, much like you, like there's something about watching it, seeing the palm trees, seeing the forum, seeing Magic again on TV. It's just like, it does it for me. It really does it for me.
Yeah, and I really like how they like played the forum. I remember the first time I went to the forum was actually for a concert. I think it was a Jay-Z concert.
And, oh wow, hey, that's a good show.
Yeah, that was the first time. And I remember as a sports fan, my first thing outside of seeing my favorite rapper was, man, Michael Jordan won his first championship. So it's like being in there, kind of you can kind of feel like the mystique of the forum. So the way you guys have actually able to tailor, you know, have that on screen, I felt that the same way. And that was kind of cool. Now, my introduction.
Yeah, I just want to tell you, I went last year, I took my son to see J. Cole at the forum. And the forum is an amazing venue right now.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
They've redone it. They've remastered it all. And it's a great place to see a concert, like great place.
Yes, and it's not a bad seat in there, which I like about it. And you know, it kind of feels like it's a little overshadowed now because you got the massive SoFi Stadium across the street from it now, but it's still like history. Like you don't have that many stadiums left where it just feels like history when you walk in there. And that's the feeling I get every time I walk into the forum.
I agree.
100%. But my introduction to you was actually when you did your book on Walter Payton. Now I'm a diehard Bears fan. I've had the privilege of being able to cover the team, my third season covering the team. And my introduction to that was my dad would show me Walter Payton highlights when I was a kid. And that's what, like, sucked me into it. I was like, okay, I'm a Bears fan, and that's just how it's been since then. Now, what was that whole process like, you know, working on that book? You know, what made you want to do a book on Walter and things like that?
All right, so it goes back a little way. Walter Payton died in 1999.
99, yeah.
I was a writer at Sports Illustrated at that time. I was a young, up-and-coming writer. And one of my editors said to me one day, he's like, would you want to go to Chicago and interview Walter Payton? He was dying at this point. He was like, he's trying to promote organ donation awareness. Would you want to go? Yeah, of course I want to go. You know, you don't turn down an opportunity to interview Walter Payton. So I fly out to Chicago and I drive out to his office in the suburbs. And this old guy answers the door. He's an old guy and he's wearing like a taxi driver's cap and his windbreaker is too big. Old African-American man. And I realize it's Walter Payton. Like he was shrunken beyond recognition. And it was crushing. And we sat down and I talked to him. And it was very sad, very heartbreaking. He knew he was going to die at this point. His eyes were yellow from jaundice. And that stuck with me. When I thought about, when I'm always thinking about what book to write next, you always think, like, you want someone who's iconic.
Right.
You want someone where maybe a great book hasn't been done yet. And you want a book that you're going to really get into. And I just thought, like, he's an icon. He's fascinating. He died. There's a full life story there. And I just like, I dove in. That was the hardest book I've ever worked on by far, hands down. So ridiculously challenging. It's hard because in this business, it's an interesting business being a writer, right? Like right. You basically have to decide, am I writing books? If you're going to be a biographer, it sounds like a hoity term, but if you're going to be a biographer, you're either telling a full story of someone or you're not. You're either writing about mythology or writing true story. And Walter Payton had a lot of sort of, you know, like by the end of his life, he had taken a lot of painkillers. He probably suffered from CTE. He wasn't loyal to his wife at all. He was very depressed. And his last few years were really sad, really sad. So I knew I had to write about that. So it was not an overly fun process, you know, like right. A lot of darkness in his life. But I also found what I found really inspired about Walter Payton is like at the end of his life, he really wanted people. He didn't want to disappoint people. Like he wanted people to know that he stood for something and that he wanted to make sure people knew to donate the organs and to do the right thing. And the whole thing was just crushing.
Yeah, from what I remember a little bit, that whole little dark time is right when my dad like kind of introduced him. It was right before he died. It was right before he died when I kind of got in tune with it. But let's just say the one of the last things I got for you is is there any story or like any athlete or maybe any period in time of sports that you haven't written about that you were like, oh, I would love to write about this?
Well, my dream book isn't a sports book. My dream book would be a Tupac biography.
Okay.
Right. I love Tupac. He's one of the biggest writing influences and just musical influences in my life. I find him fascinating. So I guess my answer, I don't have very great. I mean, the thing is this, right? There are sports books that would be really fun for me to write. I grew up a diehard New York Jets fan in the 80s, right? I'd love to write a book about the 80s Jets, but who's buying it? You know, like who's buying a book about the 1980s New York Jets? You really want to read about Bill Bryan? Nobody. So you have to be careful about your topics and you have to think about, I'm not at that level. I'm not like Stephen King where I can just put out a book and everyone's going to buy it. You know, I have to
just, okay. Well, with Tupac, what, you know, stood out to you about Pac? I'm a huge Pac fan too.
Like, oh, are you?
Yeah. I'm outside of Jay. That's my favorite rapper. Like what about Pac? Like would make you want to like divulge now, especially with all the stories we already have about Pac.
Okay. So the thing about Tupac that I find fascinating is like, he was a real contradiction. Right. Like, he went to the Baltimore School of Performing Arts as a kid and was a, like, by all accounts, I think like a really brilliant young actor. And also like, if you listen to interviews from when he was young, he was almost effeminate. Like he was very like, he wasn't like later on the persona he adopted after doing Juice was not a young Tupac at all. You know, he was like. He almost sounded like he could be like Leonardo DiCaprio describing his role in Titanic. Like he was very like, I don't know, like really actory. Right. And he became this guy, you know, and especially after, you know, when he got out of prison and he was bailed out by Suge and he had to sign the deal. He bailed him out for $3 million. And he had to sign the deal with Death Row. Like something changed in that guy. And I'm fascinated. Like, was it a real change? Was he just adopting to where he was? And I also like, his death pisses me off because it all feels really unnecessary. And I just think he was a genius. And I think that guy would have gone on, honest to God, I think he would have gone on to have a De Niro type acting career. I think if you ever, have you seen Poetic Justice?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
That movie is dog shit. But he's great. He has a bad, actually a bad
movie. It really is. It really is.
He's great. You can't stop watching Tupac.
Yeah.
And Poetic Justice. And it's so funny. That movie has gained more allure than any movie that's not good ever. Like, people talk about it like it's freaking Casablanca. It's like one of the worst movies. And
I feel the same way about Love and Basketball too. It's like,
don't tell my wife that. Yeah, for sure. But like, I mean, even Juice isn't that great of a movie, but like, he's great. And like, he has a thing people talk about. We just follow him on the screen left and right. And I think a lot of that persona with Death Row at the end was him sort of playing up to what he felt he was supposed to be. And I just think he was a lot smarter than a guy like Suge Knight. I think he was a lot deeper than a guy like Suge Knight. I just think he got caught up in it. And I'm haunted, as are a lot of people, by what he could have been. I don't know. Do you disagree with that?
No, I'm 100% with you. I feel like with him and Biggie, it's kind of like the potential that was there. Like, even with, like, I listened to, you know, really Biggie a little more sort of Pac, because I feel like Pac, even though he's only here 25 years, he kind of lived a full life in those 25 years. Like, when I listen to Biggie's last album, I get angry because it's like, man, he was getting so better. You know, he was getting so much better. With Pac, it's like he had the whole world in front of him. And since I've moved to LA and I've talked to people who are from here and I know more about what really went down, it sounds even more unnecessary.
It pisses me off. The whole thing pisses me off, right? Because it's two guys with so much talent, like so much talent, oozing talent. I mean, Biggie, I mean, come on. He's one of the freaking great lyricists of all time. Phenomenal. Yeah. And like, you got like, you didn't have to freaking, like, it didn't have to be this way. It pisses me off. I get it. It's not that easy to escape the lifestyle. And there is an authenticity to both those guys. But like, it was such a stupid time period in hip hop in a lot of ways. You know, like, you don't see like J. Cole and Kendrick Lamar getting in peace for their guns. It was stupid. Like, you guys need it. You're brilliant lyricists and you're brilliant thinkers. And like, for it to end that way is just senseless. And when people say like, well, Tupac's legacy lives on forever, it's like, yeah, but he's dead. Like, he's not here to enjoy it. He's not here to create new material. He's not here to enjoy what maybe he would have had kids and eventually grandkids and had this life. It's just tragic, man. I don't know if you live out here. Did you go to the exhibit, the Tupac exhibit?
Yeah, I've been to the Tupac exhibit. I've actually, like, the weird thing for me is, like, when I go on, like, my walks and stuff in the morning, like, the hospital that Biggie died in is, like, not far from me.
Biggie or Tupac? Whatsoever.
Biggie. Like,
oh, wow.
Like, yeah, Biggie. It's not that far from me. And just the whole little thing. I've been so, like, enamored kind of with that era. Like, you know, that's kind of like when I started listening to rap. And of course, you know, I'm 8, 9 years old, so I don't know exactly what's going on. I'm just when my cousins were playing around, but I did like so much research around it, like being out here and being at these spots, you know, seeing where certain Tupac videos were shot at, or you know, seeing where, you know, what happened, like when people talk about the last night that Biggie was here, that was over there on Wilshire Boulevard, you know, in the middle of Beverly Hills. Like, this stuff is like real. And with Pac, I feel like, you know, to me, he's like in the top three, I feel like, in LA, where it's like these guys will forever be immortal. It's Tupac, it's Kobe Bryant, and Nipsey Hussle. Like, you can't go anywhere without seeing a mural of those guys, anything. You just really feel it differently when you're here.
If I were ranking the three as far as LA immortality, I think I'd probably go Kobe, Tupac, Nipsey.
Yes. Great. Yeah. Yeah.
It is interesting, I will say. I wrote that Kobe book. I mean, the, you know, Three Ring Circus, but I'm from New York, just like you're from Chicago. And I don't think until Kobe died, I realized the massive, massive imprint he had on LA. Like, I knew he was a star and I knew he was big, but like, you know, Patrick Ewing dies in New York, it's not even near, or whoever, you know, like, I guess if Jordan had died in Chicago, sure. But like, there are very few stars that impact a city, like a city where that connective tissue between star and city, like Kobe in LA. I have never seen anything like that.
And especially since it's been like, because I know a lot of people told me, like, when Shaq got traded, so a lot of people in LA were not happy with Kobe.
Oh.
When Shaq got traded, it's like to see him kind of come from that to being, you know, what he is today, what his legacy is today. You can really just see how much people love it. And I'm a diehard Kobe fan. Like, I got a picture of him in my room. Like, I love that dude. So it's like, so for me, it's like, even see like the praise he getting. I was like, I've been saying, I was yelling at lunch tables when I was in school about the guy, man. So it's just like, you know, when it comes, like, let's just say you guys did a show on that. Like, I feel like the actor, the person you pick for Kobe would have to be like, that has to be nailed. Cause that would be somebody I feel like would be super criticized for wasn't picked right.
I also think you have to do what they did with this show. Like, you couldn't, it wouldn't work because he's too old now, but you couldn't just be like, Michael B. Jordan is going to play Kobe.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Because too many people think of Michael B. Jordan as this character and that character and that character. And I think the smart thing they did with Magic, like, you could, like, you couldn't have taken a young, well-known African-American actor who's been in a bunch of things and made a Magic. You needed to take someone who just specifically oozed Magic Johnson. And I think the same with Kobe, and I think the same with Shaq. You can't just take a big guy and make him Shaq. You need to, has to be someone who has that exuberance. Like, the guy who plays Kareem, Solomon Hughes, is a PhD. Like, the guy actually is really cerebral and pretty quiet. So it works really, and he happens to be 7 feet tall. So it works very well.
Yeah, and he really has Kareem's demeanor. Like, I've met Kareem before, and he's tallest. I met Kareem and Shaq, and Kareem is the tallest guy I've ever met. Shaq is the biggest dude I've ever met. Like, it's two different things, but, like, you definitely have to nail them, especially with Magic still out here. You see Shaq on TV every Thursday. I mean, whether he's DJing or something, so you definitely have to get those guys. My last question, this is
I've enjoyed this very much, by the way.
Oh, thank you, man. I'm definitely glad we could talk about it. Was there any story on you know, in your book or any story that you guys had for this show that was too outrageous to make the cut?
Do you know the story about the cocaine and the donkeys?
No, I do not.
I'm just kidding. I made that up. Oh, okay. No, not that I know of. I mean, I don't know. Like, people always ask me, like, so what'd you leave out of the book? And I'm like, I mean, if it was good and I could verify it, I wouldn't leave it out of the book. You know, there's certain stories as a journalist that either they're too far-fetched or they're legally, debatable or whatever. So you don't, you know, but if there's a good, like, I wrote a book about the Dallas Cowboys of the 1990s called Boys of the Boys.
I would love to see something on that. That would be great.
Me too. And the book opens with Michael Irvin stabbing a teammate in the neck with a pair of barber scissors.
Yeah.
And those kind of scenes, like, are, I mean, those are gems when you can get them as a writer, but they're hard to get and they're hard to verify. So you have to make sure your stuff is right. So I don't have a great answer for you.
Well, I know the one, you know, Wood Harris's character, his name is Spencer Haywood. Spencer Haywood. Like, people was like, did he really put like a hit on the Lakers and so on? Like, it was like, what, for people who don't know, what was that like, as spot on as it was on there, or was that a little blown up too?
It was mostly right. So basically, Spencer Haywood is on the Lakers. He's pissed off because he's not playing. He also at the time has a heavy, heavy addiction to coke. I guess it was crack at that point. It might have been crack at that point. Anyway, he's addicted. And he's going to hire a hitman to take out. This is where they differed a little bit. The head coach was Paul Westhead. He hired a hitman to take out the brakes in Paul Westhead's car.
Damn.
And he was going to have Paul Westhead drive and have no brakes in his car. And he told the plan to his mother. This is a true story. Spencer told the plan to his mother, and his mother is like, you cannot do that. You can't do that. And he wound up not doing it. And I will tell you, one of my most embarrassing stories as a writer, I went to interview Spencer Haywood for the book. He lives in Las Vegas. He's awesome. He's been clean forever. He's a great, great guy. And I interview him, and I say, can I use your bathroom? And I use his bathroom. And all I do, I swear to God, is take a piss. And I flush the toilet, and the toilet overflows. And I'm in Spencer Haywood's house, and the water is overflowing. And, you know, like, you don't know what to do. There's no plunger there. The water's overflowing. And I'm in Spencer Haywood's house, and it starts seeping under the door into his daughter's room, which is carpeted. So this water is just pouring out of the toilet, seeping under. And I'm like, and I go out, and I'm like, hey, Spencer, do you have like a plunger? And he's like, yeah, sure. Nonchalant as anything. And I'm sitting there in Spencer Haywood's house, plunging his toilet, even though all I did was take a piss. And I wrote about that in the book.
Yeah, that definitely would have been a moment that had me like, out of all places, this had to happen right here and now, man. But thank you, man, for joining me. Thank you for giving me your time today, man. I was really excited about talking to you about this show. I really loved it. I'm really looking forward to season 2 of Winning Time that's going to be coming out. So I'm definitely looking forward to that. So thank you for joining me today.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Triple double hat trick. I know the code too. Ice tray, go for trade. Yeah, we code too.